Here, what's all this?
Keep back there.
Keep back, me? Do you know who you're talking to?
You're crazy to know who I am, aren't you? I'll show you who I am and what I am.
Greetings, mortals, and welcome to another episode of A Podcast But Evil. I'm Dan Oster.
And I'm Doug Lee.
And today our guest isn't here. I don't see him, Doug. Whoa, what's going on? Who are we doing today?
It's an audio medium. We can't see anything.
That's true.
We're doing The Invisible Man.
Yes.
Specifically, H.G. Wells's and Claude Rains's Invisible Man, since, as I'm sure we'll talk about, there have been many, many invisible men and women over the course of storytelling and cinema history.
It's true. There is the Invisible Woman from Fantastic mm-hmm. Four. I hope we talk about her.
There was an Invisible Woman as a sequel to the old 1933 movie as well.
Oh, wow. So, yeah. Cool. Yeah. That highest of glass ceilings. Invisibility. Yes.
And we will.
Is it even sure there? We'll I don't know. Fantastic. Hey, early on, we like to always remind you guys, if you're enjoying the podcast, not just this episode, but if you've listened in the past and you haven't left a review, we would really appreciate it on Apple Podcasts. It helps us get the word out. This is the first time you're listening, I wouldn't expect you to leave a review based on the last 60 seconds. I certainly hope you wouldn't. But yeah, there's something to consider. And of course, you can always reach out to us at Podcast But Evil.
So I was thinking we could start off this podcast as we usually do. But even before that, you know, have you actually seen any of the Invisible Man movies, Dan? What's your level of
familiarity with this? Just the one with Chevy Chase. No.
We can talk about Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
I have not seen these movies. That's a lie. Very recently, I did see the one with Elizabeth Moss.
Mm-hmm.
That's her name, right? I've got that correct?
Yes, correct. Okay. Yeah, from Peggy Olson from Mad Men.
Right. I saw that one and it was good. But it definitely felt, even not really knowing H.G. Wells' story backwards and forwards, I could tell this was a pretty significant departure from it. It was sort of like an Invisible Man, not exactly the Invisible Man. I mean, this, we can talk about the differences because there are many. As a standalone story, I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah. In fact, they're all, with the exception of the original Claude Rains movie, none of them are adaptations of the H.G. Wells book. They're all just other stories about invisible people. And it's not like, and H.G. Wells is not the first person to write a story about invisibility either. And I'm sure we'll get into that as well. So this is probably a good chance to start off with our usual. Dan, what do you know about this particular Invisible Man without having done any research?
This Invisible Man, this one right here.
Griffin. His name is Griffin.
His name is Griffin. Okay, thanks for giving me that, for slipping me that one.
Yeah.
I know his name is Griffin. All right. Well, The Invisible Man. First of all, I actually have a question for you before I get into this. Is this the first instance we have in fiction of the power of invisibility?
Not even by a long shot. No.
Okay, good. Well, I hope we can dig into that. But let's stick to this for just one second. All right. So H.G. Wells, of course, the author of The Time Machine and War of the Worlds. He's, turn of the century, basically. And so The Invisible Man, is he a scientist?
Yes. Doctor. Yes.
A doctor. Okay. And I'm going to start trying to just like read your facial cues to see when I'm close.
Warmer.
I'm conflating it with things like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That was that Robert Louis Stevenson who wrote that?
I believe that's, it's not Wells. Right. I believe it's Stevenson.
You're right. It feels like Wells, though. That's the funny thing. It feels like such a Wellsian thing. It's like all the Spider-Men villain have the same origin. They're like well-meaning scientists turned evil by science. That's kind of what I feel like is what's going on here, is that he somehow, through an experiment, is turned invisible. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So he becomes invisible. And all I really know past that point, in quotes, is that he's sort of driven mad by it. And I feel like there's sort of a message here that when no one's watching you, what do you become, right? Like, without the constraints of society, does a man just sort of become a crazy criminal because he literally cannot be seen? His actions can literally not be seen. So that's all I really have for you on The Invisible Man.
Well, you really did hit, I think, the kind of the key components of it. Of the Wells story in particular. So we hit on this already, but H.G. Wells is far from the first person to tell an invisibility story. He's one of the first to put a sci-fi spin on it. He is, really, really is the father of modern science fiction, even more so than some of his contemporaries like Jules Verne. And we can talk a bit about why H.G. Wells is so special in a little bit. But getting to this particular piece of the puzzle, in doing my research for this, I found that Wells was inspired by a number of invisibility stories, but in particular one called The Ring of Gyges, which is a story written by Plato, to give you an idea of how long this has been around.
Wow.
And Plato is not the only figure from Greek antiquity to toy with this. Way back, we did a podcast on Medusa. And in the Perseus story, Perseus, the warrior who slays Medusa, there are versions of that story where instead of using a mirrored shield, he uses some magical gewgaw to turn himself invisible or to cloak himself in invisibility. Mm-hmm. So it's been around for a while, but the Ring of Gyges is important because it hits on that other theme you mentioned, which is the corruption. So we've also done an episode about a ring that turns you invisible and corrupts you. Like, these ideas have been in the mix for a long, long, long time. And
hey, webheads, check out our episode on Sauron to hear more about the invisibility ring.
Who's that voice?
Stan Lee. You know, they always put like,
oh, Stan Lee. Okay.
They'd be like, editor's note, you know, Spidey's talking about when Venom and he, you know.
Okay.
Check out issue number 67.
It's Stan Lee by way of Snarf.
Got it.
Snarf. Lion-O.
But yes, the corruption of that, it's about a guy who he goes in a cave, he finds a magic ring that makes him invisible, and he's an ordinary guy. And by the end of the story, he's the king because he's used that power to depose the king and take over. And it is all about that kind of corruption. So Wells is working off of that kind of stuff.
I wonder how he did that. It's like, this guy can't be the king. Every time we have dinner, pies just start flying around. we need a new king.
And Wells, by this point, when he writes this book, by the way, comes out in 1897. The Time Machine, which is his first real book and his big breakthrough, is 1895.
Were these kinds of stories that were published in periodicals initially?
I know the Time Machine was. I'm not sure about The Invisible Man. I reread the book. It's been a while. It's not that long. But I did reread the book for this, and it reads like a periodical. It feels that way. It's very, you know, very little chapters and kind of – it's very episodic in the way it's told. H.G. Wells as a person is interesting because he – was not an upper class guy. You know, he's kind of a working class guy who, you know, started off kind of struggling both professionally and personally. And there's a little bit of that you can see in these books, not just this one, but the Time Machine.
Because the original title was The Toy Machine, is it?
Yeah. Well, it's written in a horrendous Cockney accent. It's very hard to read.
We're going to the future, are we?
Sorry.
But the centerpiece of the Time Machine is literally a class conflict between pretty people who live on the surface and the Morlocks who are, you know, ghouls that live underground.
That's true.
So the people
who live up top. I remember that.
Yeah. And some of that leaks into the Invisible Man, too. And particularly like the Invisible Man himself. We should talk about who he is in the book, because the story ends up being kind of a it's showy because it's all about how cool this invisibility power is. And he's a sci-fi writer. He really wants to get into the ins and outs of like, well, how does it work? And, you know, how does it affect him? But as a human being, he's interesting because he is, even before he's invisible, he's a little invisible. He's, you know, he's a loner, keeps to himself. He's an albino, which is a key point in the book because he says that's something that it allows him to become invisible. Because he talks about like, I could make most things invisible, but one of the stumbling blocks was skin pigmentation. But guess what? I don't have any, which means that hurdle to invisibility is removed for me.
Interesting.
Yeah. So he ends up, he steals money from his father to finance the experiments. And the father ends up killing himself out of like, you know, poverty. And he doesn't seem to be too affected by it. He's a little sociopathic already.
Even before he's made himself invisible.
Right. So he's,
is there any, is it somewhat problematic in terms of like casting an albino as like a sociopathic strange figure? Is it one of those stories? You know what I mean? Does it kind of dip into that a little too much?
No, it doesn't dip into it a lot. It does. It's mentioned. It's obviously brought up because it's important. He doesn't spend a lot of the story talking about.
It's just like this otherness that you can use. You can do that poorly. I'm not saying that that's what's happening here, right? I mean, there's a character. I'm not saying I haven't seen it, but the Da Vinci Code. Isn't there like a sinister Albino?
Yeah, there is. I mean, so anytime you pick, like take a person and make them they're on the outside of society looking in, you run that risk. Here, sure. I think it
works. You can also do it. Yeah, you can do it artfully, like The Hunchback of Notre Dame, things like that.
Yeah, and this works. It's more in that vein, in that, again, he doesn't really talk about how it felt to be an albino, that people would look at him weird. It's just kind of a detail that's dropped in there. But they do talk. I mean, again, he's working at a university. He's studying. He's working under a guy who he thinks is likely to steal any breakthrough he makes. So he kind of like secrets himself away. You find some like low, shitty, loft apartment to rent away from everybody else while he works on these experiments kind of by himself for 6 years before he pulls it off. So you're talking about a guy who is deliberately removing himself from society even before he actually makes himself literally invisible. And I think that's a pretty key piece of that puzzle. As far as the class stuff that Wells likes to get into.
In what way?
Well, again, it's not a coincidence that there is a book about this, which is obviously not about literal invisibility, but there's the book by Ellison called Invisible Man, which is about an African-American man who is treated as though he was literally invisible. And Ellison is making a direct link to Wells about this character. But some of that stuff is still in this book. It's not about, a particular issue like race, but it is about that general feeling that some people are just marginalized or just they're on the out, even if it's just because of their personality, not because of their identity. It's just this person is clearly on the outside of society looking in.
It's a really resonant concept, I think, right now, especially with the internet. We're hearing about so many people who feel marginalized or perhaps are sort of seduced into a mindset of marginalization and removing themselves from society, becoming sort of socially withdrawn and such. So that is, it's not a new problem, but it seems especially resonant today.
Yeah. And when they got to the Claude Rains movie, the 1933 Universal horror classic, they had to kind of dial that back a little bit because they felt like he needed more of a backstory. He needed other characters to interact with, to be part of the story that were not necessarily total strangers to him. In the book, there's one guy.
So he really doesn't have any connection to society in the book.
Yeah, really not. Like the first, I would say at least half of the book is entirely him interacting with strangers. And then he gets to a point where he's wounded and he goes and he hides out at the house of this guy named Kemp, who is like a fellow scientist that he knew, not well, but like an acquaintance. Even he's not like a close friend, but he's someone he knew. And he tries to like have that guy, give him a place to nurse himself back to health. And then he tries to pull him in as like, I need a visible partner to help me. That guy's in the Rains movie as well. But in the Rains movie, they also gave him a love interest or a former love interest and her father, who's another scientist, from the university or whatever. So a few more people in his orbit because I think they felt that's a screenwriting problem that you have to solve rather than a book writing problem where you can more easily just say, yeah, dude's a loner. He's on his own. That's a big part of the story.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The other major difference between the Universal movie and the book is they focus a little more on the madness angle, and they try to slip in there that it's a pharmacological effect of the invisibility drug, whereas the book doesn't do that as much. They try to – I think Wells is working off more the idea that it's his predicament that is driving him insane, that he's made himself invisible. He can't undo it. And now he is stuck because
resonant concept than, you've been turned crazy by a drug.
Yeah, I think the movie is still deft enough to leave it in there that like you're still going, well, one read of it is that it's the drug. The other read is still the Wellesian read that it's, he's now put himself in this horrible situation. But
what year was that movie made? What year did the movie come out?
33. 1933. So, and it actually had a lot of input from Wells. The movie had been in what we would now call development hell for years as people were trying to like crack it. And the solution.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure a lot of special effects had to be invented for the film.
That too. They had to obviously work out how to do it. But the bigger issue was actually the story. They couldn't get the story to work right. And they kept changing it around until finally someone said, well, why don't we just, you know, do what's in the book? You know, that somebody already cracked this story, and it was H.G. Wells. Apparently, the version
you're fired.
Yeah,
get out.
Yep, and they brought in James Whale to direct it, and James Whale was the director of Frankenstein 2 years earlier. So he had already made a name for himself by directing a smash horror movie, and I think there was one other one that is not as well known. I can't remember the name of it between The Invisible Man and that, but he brought in kind of an interesting sensibility. Like one thing you kind of remember from Frankenstein is all these very colorful,
it's alive. Townies. It's alive. Oh, the cow. Okay. I
was like, I'm talking about more like your dudes moment. With torches and pitchforks and like, you know, it's a monster. Okay. It is a lot of that.
Yeah. One of those was H.G. Wells.
Yeah.
You got to have a cameo.
That's right.
well, I wrote this story.
And so the movie has this interesting tone to it where, like, it is still a monster movie, but it does have a little bit of this, like, humorous streak in it. And it makes it for a really fun watch.
I should go visit it.
You should revisit it. It's not that long. It's like 70-some-odd
minutes. No, just visit
minutes.
It. I've never seen it. So.
Oh, man, yeah. It's great. I was really excited to hadn't watched it in many, many years, and it was fun to go back to it because – Claude Rains is incredible.
Yeah, this was a good opportunity for our sort of our unofficial segment of connecting the villain to the Joker, which we seem to do a lot.
Yeah. Go ahead. I watched this too. It's awesome.
Yeah, one of the big influences on Mark Hamill's version of the Joker, very iconic performance in the animated series, he has said is Claude Rains in The Invisible Man.
Yeah, and Claude Rains, I watched an interesting thing on the making of it, and they said his audition sucked. It was really terrible, but James Whale was like, no. Forget the fact that he's hamming it up and overacting. You're not going to see him. Listen to his voice.
Oh,
and based on that, they decided to go with him. And at this point, Claude Rains was an unknown. He had like a stage career, and your listeners might know him best for his role in Casablanca. He is Louis, as in Louis. I think this is the beginning of A Beautiful Friendship. That's Claude Rains. And he's great in that. But here he's going full maniacal. Like, as you said, there's a reason that he's the inspiration for the Joker's voice.
Yeah.
Later.
I mean, I think the voice I have in my head is Mark Hamill doing an impression of him, you know, in the interview where he mentions, like, I'm not crazy, you're crazy, you know?
Yeah. That's, yeah. That, I mean, and I think I sent you the clip of like that moment from the movie where he's at the beginning of the movie.
And there are
the
some
Wells
colorful
story.
Townies in that clip. You're right. There's a police officer who's got, like, you know, a bobby.
Oh, what's all this then?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you're telling us to let you go, you know? And then he's like, he pulls off the bandages and everything, and then he's not there and they flip out.
Yeah, I love that look too. That's such an iconic look. And it is he is described as looking like that in the Wells story that he's
we all kind of look like that right now when we go outside.
I was thinking about that. You know, like now we're all literally wearing masks and walking around and you can't tell who anybody is. And like it was here's something that was weird. So my daughter's in daycare or preschool and she has to wear a mask there. And they send us pictures throughout the day every once in a while, like, oh, here she is, on the jungle gym or having lunch or whatever. And she sends, I get a picture from the teacher that's like, it's circle time. Like they're all the kids are gathered around. And I looked at, and I went like, oh, that's too bad. She must have, you know, had an accident today because she's not wearing the same clothes that she left the house in. And then I looked and it took me a second to realize, like, oh, no, that's not my daughter. My daughter's on the other side of the picture. And it was this other blonde-haired little girl in a mask. And I'm like, oh, I mistook my own daughter.
Wow. You know, strange, yeah. But, yeah, no, it's interesting, though, to bring it back to the themes of this, the social isolation thing, we're all dealing with a version of that. Right now, obviously, as we're all trapped in our homes, some of us with people around, some of us not. And you go out into the world, and God, you can't even look at a person's face, right? I mean, unless they're an asshole and they're not wearing a mask.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, like, we're all sort of hidden, and I think that's got to be really hard for a lot of folks to just have to live under that kind of isolation right now, to just literally not be able to have some of these basic interactions, even with strangers, really, where you just have face-to-face contact, so... I think we're feeling a bit of some of that same
angst,
angst and depression that this character, Griffin, is feeling on a much larger level, you know, to the point where it manifests physically. And, you know, anyway, I just think that's interesting. This is a story that probably really resonates right now.
I think so. And I think that aspect of the story to me is really interesting because Wells is one of the things that makes him kind of the premier sci-fi writer and like the towering legend in this genre that he is that he's able to so deftly marry that, these deep philosophical concepts with a really entertaining, like comic booky right. almost story, because he loves to geek out in the book. He'll talk because he starts thinking about, well, how would it really work, right? And he's like, oh, okay. Like at one point, the Invisible Man, when he holds up with Kemp, this is when we finally start getting a lot of him talking about, you know, what he's been going through and the backstory and how he became invisible. And he starts to figure out, like, here's all the things I had to figure out once I became invisible. Like, well, one, unless I'm totally naked, it doesn't do anything. And therefore, for me to have an advantage, I have to be like physically exposed, which, remember, this story takes place in England. So it's cold.
I see. Yeah.
And to some degree, look, it's
foggy.
I was
in the pool.
Well, he says, like, if it's foggy, I just look like a bubble in the fog. Oh, like, you'll see me. Yeah. If it's snowy, you'll see the snow on me.
Right.
If rain. Yeah. So you can start geeking out of like, well, wait a minute. What happens when he eats? And he says, well, if I eat, it's got to be like an hour or so before the food gets absorbed. So you would see it. So I have to, he says it's gross. He's like, I got to hide that. He's got to be super clean all the time because he's like, look, if there's even dirt under
turds,
my finger.
My turds, they are invisible, but my pee is not, you know.
Well, he says, like, you know, if there's dirt under my fingernails, it'll ruin the effect. So I have to be super clean all the time. He wears the goggles to some degree, you know, because it hurts his eyes because he's got light coming in from all angles. He can't. I think technically you probably would be unable to see at all if you were invisible because it would, you know, you don't have a lens, you don't have a pupil or you know, an iris to control the amount of light.
Thanks, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Just let us have this.
Yeah. But to some degree, Wells
does do that.
In the
real world, the force wouldn't exist. You know, it's like, okay, thanks. We get it.
He does love to kill Joy a little bit, Mr.
but
DeGrasse
we love
Tyson.
You. But we love you anyway. Actually, you should be a villain. We should do get him on as a guest.
But yeah, it is cool to see Wells do that himself of like, I'm going to play with this concept and like, you know, where does it go?
Yeah, and, well, I agree with you that, like, he one of the reasons he endures is he gets a really great idea that has a resonant concept or a theme that you can relate to on an emotional level, and he also has fun with the how would it actually go part, which for a lot of people is exciting, you know? The book The Martian, I feel like, is all that. It's like, okay, if you were stuck on Mars, how would you survive? And that's the whole book. It's like, okay, here's all the ways he does. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's nothing but like puzzles that are thrown in front of him that are life and death.
Right. And I'm not usually as into that. I'm more usually into just the emotional side of the stories. And The Martian has some of that, but it really is mostly just a puzzle that is getting solved in the book. And it's great.
And Wells does that here as well. There's some of it. A lot of the book is spent with also like not just the technical problems of like how do I maintain the, you know, my invisibility without being detected. There's also like functional things of like, oh shit, I need money to eat, to live. I need a place to stay. And like he doesn't have access to that stuff. So he's constantly having to like, it's like I can steal money, but the money is visible. I gotta, you know, be very careful.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a monkey's paw element to this, which is like, now that you have this thing, it's actually a huge pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's very clear. I think they do a good job of selling this in the book and in the movie that he's gotten himself in over his head. He was so entranced with the fact that he figured out how to make himself invisible that he didn't do enough on the back end of the planning of like, well, once I become invisible, how am I going to survive? And also, how do I turn myself back? And he is in his kind of mania and paranoia about keeping this thing a secret. He ends up essentially, I forget if he burns down the lab so no one can track him. He then has like a few books left, but they end up in the hands of somebody else who's, you know, there's a big side of the story, which is him like kind of stepping on a rake in terms of preventing himself from being able to turn back.
Oh, because he destroys his own research?
Yeah, he kind of, in the name of like covering his tracks, he ends up kind of covering his tracks from himself in a way that he's spends a lot of the book trying to undo.
Hmm.
And that is part of what's also driving him mad, is again, he's trapped in this situation of his own making.
So do you want to wrap up the narrative or do you want to leave it open for people who want to check it out?
No, we can wrap it up. I mean, I think this is a story that's old enough that, you know, the spoiler wall can come down.
Mild spoiler alert.
But, you know, basically, you know, he's getting chased from place to place and ends up where he is, I believe. I can't remember if the book ends this way. The movie certainly ends this way. But he ends up in the snow. And in the movie, you see, like, footprints coming out of a barn and they just shoot at where the footprints are and he's done.
His one weakness, bullets.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and he says it himself, you know, there's lots of drawbacks to this superpower that he can't work around no matter what he does.
I'm just a naked guy in the snow.
I'm a naked guy in the snow. It's hard.
It's a little bit, if I can be super nerdy for a second, I believe to be cloaked, at least for some period in the Star Trek universe, like you couldn't have shields.
Mm-hmm.
So like if you were cloaked, you were invisible, but you were super vulnerable. If someone could figure out where you were, I could be wrong. Someone could correct me on that, but I think that was true for a while. And then the ability to be cloaked and have your shields up, like that was an innovation that came later. But I don't know. I thought that was the deal, like with the Romulans who had cloaking technology.
I defer to you on this one. I do not know.
Where's Aaron when we need him? All right.
I know.
Well, if I'm wrong, then I'm wrong. But it seems like that would be when you're kind of coming up with these advantages and you still want to keep it competitive, right? That's a pretty obvious one. Okay, I can't see you, but if I know where you are, you know, it's a one-hit kill.
Right. The other thing the movie introduces that I think we should probably hit on is the megalomania, which is more of a presence in the movie than it is in the book, where, again, we're still dealing of, like, is it the drug or is it the invisibility?
He's born with it. Maybe it's Maybelline.
Right. He begins to, at different points, wax philosophical about what he's going to do. Like, he wants to, like, you know, use this power to sell it to the government. They could create an army of invisible soldiers. He talks about that. He talks about starting a reign of terror. He talks about, and he does, in fact, in the movie, he gets much more homicidal. He derails a train for seemingly no reason other than, fuck it, I'm going to kill a bunch of people.
Really?
Yeah. So he starts to really go, they show him going farther and farther off the deep end. The Kemp character who lives in the book dies in the movie. He threatens to kill him in the book, but doesn't manage to do it. In the movie, there's this awesome scene where, like, Kemp, you know, he tells Kemp, I'm going to kill you at like 10 p.m. tomorrow. And, you know, he gets the police around, there's this whole kind of action sequence of, you know, them trying to find the invisible man in Kemp's house. Kemp gets away thinking that, you know, he's in the house and I'm outside. So I'm going to get in the car and just drive as far as I can. He gets in the car. And of course, the invisible man is in the car waiting for him and then just drives him off a cliff. And you know, that's the end of him.
Just gently rests his balls on the back of his neck. And causes him to swerve and drive off.
I
got you.
Yeah. He definitely goes farther off the deep end in the movie. And I think it's effective. I think it works. Hmm. Other tidbit about the movie before we move on to other stuff. The girlfriend in the movie is Gloria Stewart. You may or may not remember that name.
Do you see the blank look on my face? Like the cow eyes I'm giving
with
you?
Well, I'll give you a hint then. The heart of the ocean.
Oh, it's the old lady from the Titanic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's how our modern listeners would know her. But the old lady from the Titanic.
Doug and I were enjoying a chicken salad. And who walks in but Gloria Stewart? You know, I love these old-timey stars that we have no idea who they are today. You do, but I don't.
Well, I only know that because I saw that and I was like, I know that name. Why do I know that name? And then I looked it up. And
I want to get into this now because I think we got some back-end stuff we can do in talking about other instances of invisible men and women. There's a lot. So let's just really quickly here address the Invisible Man as a resonant villain. You know, what about him is the concept that endures? We've sort of played with it a little bit.
I think, you've got two kind of axes on here. You've got like the cool sci-fi angle, and you've got all the themes that go with it. And the first slate of movies are all these sequels to the original, which of course are The Invisible Man is dead at the end, right, of. So you get this series of movies about different people who come the upon
Invisible
the
Pet. Formula.
Invisible Man Returns, The Invisible Woman, The Invisible Agent, and then Abbott and Costello meet the Invisible Man.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Look who's invisible too. Yeah.
Yeah. Right, yeah. By the way, this is our second villain whom Abbott and Costello have met. So there
okay,
you go.
Okay, great. So the you get first a bunch one, of course, was Idi Amin. Idi Amin was the first
right,
one.
Idi Amin. So the these to me are all just speaking to the fact that the invisibility is a cool special effect.
Right.
Like, I don't think there's anything to these movies that really plugs into the themes behind the earlier versions of this. But I think now we can move on to some of the more modern takes on it.
Well, okay, so I would be in terms of the enduring qualities of this character, though, I don't want to just paper over. We'll just restate it, I guess, just this idea of when you're invisible, when you're not seen by society, what does that do to somebody and what does it drive them to? And
right,
when those constraints are gone, you know, what is the dark heart that's inside of all of us? I think that is kind of what's cool about this character in particular.
And that's why, I mean, I think, you know, he is considered one of the universal capital U monsters, you know, along with that group. And he has shown up not just in other, or not he specifically, but other versions of this have been like, he's a member of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Well, right. No, yeah, I was going to mention that when we get into sort of these other instances of the Invisible Man. So Alan Moore used him in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which was a really crappy movie, but a much cooler comic book that had a bunch of these characters from essentially like Victorian English literature, all in sort of their own kind of Avengers or Justice League type scenario, but more morally complex and weird because it's Alan Moore. So you had like Alan Quartermain and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and all that stuff, and the Invisible Man. And even in that group, though, the Invisible Man was an untrustworthy kind of a guy. I mean, he was sort of a turncoat, I think, ultimately in that.
Yeah, story. Yeah, you're right. He betrays them to the Martians.
From War of the Worlds, yeah.
From War of the Worlds, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I read something that said, like, yeah, the reason that was done was they felt like, well, you know, one, the Invisible Man is, you know, untrustworthy. And also, they're both H.G. Wells' creations, so it made sense for them to kind of, like, team them up.
Yeah, they're on the same frequency.
Yeah.
So, of course, you see him in that, and those are pretty cool comic books. And Abbott and Costello, okay. Where else have we seen invisible men or women? We set the Fantastic Four, Sue Storm. She's invisible.
And, of course, its spiritual sort of cousin, which is the Incredibles. You have the daughter,
right,
Violet.
Right. Interesting that they decided to give her two powers, you know?
Well, they gave her the same two powers that Sue Storm has, right?
Oh, does Sue Storm also have the ability to create sort of
force fields? Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. It's almost like, that's not enough. We also have to give you this because they don't seem related.
Elastigirl is Mr. Fantastic. She stretches. Mr. Incredible is basically the Thing. He's big and strong. And the Sun is a speedster rather than a Human Torch. But you can still see there's kind of a one-to-one.
Well, there's a limited number of superpowers out there. Yeah. By the way, I should mention, you know, I wanted to say this before we get too deep into these other instances. Just talking about the enduring idea of invisibility. And maybe that's why you see it pop up in so many other places. There's the age-old question, which I think stems from the This American Life episode of flight versus invisibility. This is the old conundrum.
Wow.
Are you familiar with this, Doug?
Oh, no, I've heard. I didn't know it came from This American Life, but I mean,
I believe it did. This is a great episode, so you can go find that online, I think, for free and listen to it. But this is the question, you know, if you could only have either flight or invisibility, what would it be? And if I recall, you know, they talk about sort of, I think where they kind of land with it is if you choose flight, you're sort of aspirational. It's like what you think you could be. And invisibility is sort of like what you think you really are, you know? Flight,
do you
want
to hide?
Because it's so ostentatious, right? It's so visible, flight. Invisibility is, yes, by its very nature, it's unseen and sneaky. But they're both very limiting, if you think about it. I mean, pure flight is it's not a lie. Without the ability to like have super strength or invulnerability or whatever, you don't have to take a plane. But they also sort of talk in the episode too about like, well, you know, is it cold? And how fast do you fly? And all the negotiation starts and all that stuff. But anyway, I thought that was interesting as sort of putting those on two ends of a spectrum of the superpower realm.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, you know, certainly Wells and the James Whale movie spent a lot of time talking about the drawbacks of invisibility. In fact, so much so, obviously, that is a big driver of his insanity. Now, I presume in the This American Life version, you can turn it on and off.
They have to set some rules. It's a fun episode. They kind of go through like when people start hedging and they want to know more about like, okay, how fast can you fly and do you have to be naked to be invisible? They go through all that and they kind of lay it down. But it's all pretty basic, what you would expect stuff. There, you don't get any additional juju on top of it. You got to go with what that essential ability. So anyway, I only say that to get it in there because I feel like it's something we should just name check. And then the other reason I think it's important is because, well, okay, you see, just like you see a lot of flying characters, you see a lot of invisible characters.
Well, Harry Potter, you know, is a good example. That character is in the first Harry Potter book. He receives the cloak of invisibility that he uses for the rest of the series. Now, it means anytime he wants to be invisible, he's got to like basically put a blanket over and, you know, like it was an old crummy ghost costume. He's got a hang.
There's also, you know, it's funny that we talked about Lord of the Rings and the ring, but also there's like an elven cloak that does that, isn't there? Isn't there also like an invisibility
in
cloak?
In Lord of the Rings?
I don't know. All right. Maybe I'm wrong, but
you could be right.
I thought there was like an elven, some magic that also could render you invisible. Maybe I'm conflating that with Harry Potter. All right. So yeah, you've got the invisibility there. We've got Fantastic Four. There were some movies that play with it. We talked about that Chevy Chase movie, Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Did you see that?
I saw it a long time ago. Yeah, it was like it's hard to kind of tie that to this because it is very clearly, I don't know if it's funny, but it's supposed to be a comedy.
I thought it was Chevy Chase trying to branch out, you know, it was like a dramedy kind of a thing. That's how I
remember
that.
At some point he gives some like impassioned, like, give me back my molecules or some line like that. Or I want my molecules back. But yeah, he is involuntarily rendered invisible in that movie due to a lab accident.
Right.
And then is like on the run from, you know, government goons.
That's that one. That one does not endure. There's Hollow Man with Kevin Bacon.
Now, Hollow Man, Hollow Man and then the 2020 Invisible Man movie. I don't think Hollow Man's a great movie necessarily, but at least it does very much tie into kind of the original themes that, you know, he subjects himself to an experiment. It makes him invisible. They can't figure out how to turn him back. He starts going crazy, not clear whether it's the invisibility or the drugs or a combo. So it does at least try to bring back some of the Wellesian stuff from from his original work. I can't speak to how successful it was. I saw it once in the theater, I think when it came out in, was it 2001, something like that? A long time ago now. But I'd be scared of invisible Kevin Bacon.
I'm scared of visible Kevin Bacon. All right. Are there any other ones before we get to the 2021? Were there any other ones in there that you can think of?
I'm sure I looked at a list of like movies that had The Invisible Man or some version of it in there. But those are the ones that stand out. But you'll have to speak to the 2020 movie because I haven't actually seen it.
I saw it very recently. And as I mentioned, it was good, but it was very different. First of all, you're not following the Invisible Man as a character in it, the person who's invisible. You're following Elizabeth Moss, and she is essentially somebody who emancipated herself from a really abusive relationship. She escaped, and this guy had been working on this technology. I don't think she even knew that at the time. You know, I think so part of the movie is her just like figuring out that like, because he fakes his death. And so then part of it is her realizing that he's not dead. And in fact is in the room with her right now.
No one
believes her. And I think the area of research he was working in was like optics. So it's like, okay, this makes sense, but no one believes her. And so it becomes very much an exploration of domestic abuse, specifically in that way that no one believes her, and also in the way that it follows her wherever she is. The trauma of this. I mean, he's in the room with her all the time. Or is he? You know what I mean? So I think those elements, he could be. He is always metaphorically, but he could be literally. And I think these are the elements that they pulled out and sort of told a new story with a new twist that's pretty unrelated to the original H.G. Wells story, you know, really, really taking it more from the point of view of somebody who's been victimized by this character, or rather, you know, survived his abuse. So it's good. It's exciting. It's well told, and I think definitely worth checking out. I believe in the original conception of it, they had a very different angle. They were going to make it about the Invisible Man. I think they were going to cast Johnny Depp, and it was going to be, they were going to try to do this whole shared universe thing. That
right. Universal, I remember this is going to be part planning. Of the dark universe with the Mummy and, you know, Universal's attempt to revive that cast of characters with a shared universe.
Right. So there had been a Dracula movie that had come out. There had been a Mummy movie, and this one was also in development. And they were just going to kind of tell these stories in a different way and try to assemble. I mean, it seems like a very flawed idea from the get-go. And I think by the time this one got actually made, they had abandoned that concept and decided to just kind of go in a different direction.
And clearly for the better from the sound of it. Because I think that's a brilliant way to bring that character and that concept into the 21st century by focusing on, as you said, a theme that's not really present in Wells' book, but very much possible based on the concept, right? That, you know, it almost feels as if Elizabeth Moss is invisible to everybody. You know, she is
right.
trying to get across the danger she's in without being believed. And I just feel like we had that concept at the beginning where we talked about people feeling like they're on the outside of society looking in. And there it was, the Invisible Man who's on the outside looking in. And here it's totally the inversion of that.
Right.
She's on the outside looking in, and it's the Invisible Man who is the one, you know, putting her in that position.
So I will do a spoiler alert warning on this because it just came out, and I do recommend you see it. So you can skip ahead 1 minute if you want to miss this part. But she ultimately does end up with, he uses a suit to be invisible. And so by the end, she's walking away with the suit, and you kind of wonder, okay, is she going to start being invisible? Mm-hmm. And maybe that was their way of leaving that open. If they wanted to kind of connect these things up, they were going to have Elizabeth Moss be the invisible character. Woman. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was the latest, and it was a pretty recent incarnation. Yeah, I think those are all the pop culture ones that I can think of.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, to find other instances of invisibility, you're going to, like I said, go backward at this point to see more fantasy-driven stories about invisibility that still do play with the same ideas.
I'm sorry. There's one I had forgotten, which was Mystery Men.
I've not seen Mystery Men.
There's a character in that who's like, I can turn invisible, but like no one can be looking at me or something like for me to do it. I don't know. He's got it's endearing because ultimately he's able to do it. But the whole time you're like, because they all have just like bozo powers in that, you know, there's like William H. Macy's like the shoveler, you know, he has a shovel. And yeah, like the spleen. I think Paul Rubens is like the spleen. He just farts. I don't know. They all have dumb powers. And so this guy, you're like, yeah, okay, you can be invisible, but no one has to be looking at you. But then he's able to do it at a critical moment. All right. The alignment, right?
Yeah. We can talk about the alignment. I think we've certainly talked about why the character endures. So I would put this guy, I don't know about you, I'm feeling he's more on the neutral side. When he gets crazy, when he's derailing a train, that's chaotic. Yeah, but
right. So he's like neutral with chaotic rising or something. He's got a little bit of that.
That's a good way to put it, because I think he is, you know, at least in the Wells novel, he's much more driven by self-interest. Like, I got to get back to being visible. I got to get my books back. I got to get my lab equipment back. I got to, you know, find my way back. He's fixated on that. In the movie,
I've got to get my baby back ribs. Sorry. I had to get it out there, Doug. It was in my head. It had to go.
That's fine.
Yeah. Well, he's got a goal there, a clear goal. Mm-hmm. It's not just chaos.
Yeah.
I think by the time you see him in like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, he's sort of just like a hedonist or something. You know what I mean? That's
yeah. Well, it's like, what else can I get away with now that I'm invisible?
Right, right. Yeah. You know, it reminds me of the internet trolls who like do it for the lulz, you know? Well, all right, I'm invisible. Fuck it. I'm a misanthrope. You know, what trains can I derail at this point? Right.
Right.
Just to keep it interesting for myself.
So how would you fan cast him?
I think, you know, you were onto something earlier when you said that Claude Rains got the role because of his vocal ability. So really, that's what you're thinking of more than anything else. You want somebody who sounds pretty cool. I think of, I should have been more prepared for this, but you know, he's got a great voice and ultimately was used in place of the person they had physically in the role for V for Vendetta was Hugo Weaving.
Hmm.
And
yeah.
He missed Mr. Anderson. You know, he's got that great voice. So
that's a good voice.
Just as somebody who got a role purely based on his vocal ability, he might be an interesting choice. He's certainly very menacing if he wants to be.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic choice. I my thoughts went to Benedict Cumberbatch for kind of a similar, you know, he's also got a very noticeably, you know, kind of commanding voice. And I could see, you know, if all of a sudden this booming voice is in the room with you, it's like, you know, oh shit, I better do what this thing tells me to do because I don't want to be on the receiving end of whatever it is he's planning.
Now, I don't know when we'll get a chance to reference Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds in the future.
I know. We're both devotees of this weird rock
well, you
opera
got
thing.
Me.
Am I the
you
one who got you into it? Oh, okay. One,
yeah, you. It was.
I'm Doug patient zero.
You are. You okay. Sired me. Doug is such a sweet guy, and he will burn CDs for you. At least back in the day when we did that.
Exactly. A long time ago.
The War of the Worlds rock opera that was composed by Jeff Wayne in the 70s. It's really interesting. It's like prog rock. It's awesome. It's actually pretty awesome.
It's narrated by Richard Burton.
Well, Richard Burton, this is what I was going to say, was Richard Burton, if he were still around, would probably be a good choice, too. He has such a great voice and already did the H.G. Wells thing.
They did a live concert of it.
Yeah.
Within the last few years, and they had Liam Neeson do it.
Right,
and
right.
There's another good voice.
Too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Liam Neeson's. as our good buddy Jordan Peele would call him. Yeah. All right, cool. Yeah, so those are all good choices. I like the idea of him retaining his Englishness.
Yeah.
So
I mean the book is very very English. So
yeah.
So that just leaves it's time for our title fight.
Oh, and it's also time for us to try out our new soundboard. So this is the title fight. Yeah.
If you were born before 1990, you know exactly what that track is.
Can I just offer some praise for this track? This is from Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, of course, from the Nintendo Entertainment System in the 80s. And just the pathos of this. It's got like, you know, it's just like, da-da-da-da. You know, it's got that kind of rocky quality to it. Like, oh man, like, is he going to beat Mike Tyson?
Soda Popinski is going to take me down.
Yeah. Anyway, all right, the title fight. So this is between the Invisible Man and...
Caligula.
Oh, Caligula. Huh. Two hedonists, in a way, or two guys that are unrestrained in their morality.
Yeah, totally. This is hard, because I, on the one hand... Caligula doesn't do much fighting on his own, right? It's a lot of people fighting for him. He's kind of a young guy. Although he did do that one thing where he got in a gladiator ring and managed to like stab the guy by cheating. And the Invisible Man has got to do it all with his bare hands because any weapon he's got is going to be visible.
Right.
So I don't know.
Okay, here's what happens. Caligula's having one of his bacchanalias.
Okay.
His sex party.
He's right on his sex barge.
Yeah, he's on the sex barge. And so everyone's naked. So first of all, this is an even playing field. Everyone is completely nude, including the Invisible Man who sneaks onto the barge to take out Caligula. He's so close, but then he runs into an errant spray of bodily fluid. Right in the
and
face.
And rendered
money
visible.
Shot. He's rendered visible right in his face. Caligula sees him and then stabs him. And takes it out at the last minute.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way for him to go. I tend to think the Invisible Man still wins this one.
Okay.
Because, I mean, he certainly kills his share of people in the book and in the movie. So he's not afraid to get his hands dirty and do what needs
Caligula
to be done.
Has no superpower.
He has a superpower. That's a big edge. And I think Caligula probably spent a lot of time partying and getting drunk, which means he may not have always been too cognizant of threats that might be around him. He'd rely on other people to do that. So as long as the Invisible Man can sneak past Caligula's defenses, I think, you know, he's like a 22 or 25-year-old kid. You can probably take him out.
How old is the Invisible Man, do you know, in the story?
He's got to be at least in his 30s, I think, because I think he's in...
So old. Very old.
He's in medical school, I think, when he has the breakthrough that would make invisibility possible, but it takes him 6 more years to be able to actually do it.
But back then, medical school was like 6 weeks.
Right.
It's like
this is an organ, it is.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Just bleed him. That's it. That's all I got to do.
Call blimey, 2 kidneys.
Though, as a medical doctor, he would also have an intimate understanding of the human anatomy and thus make him a more effective killer. Like the T-800, excuse me.
Right. So I think here the edge still goes to the Invisible Man. That's
all right. I begrudgingly give this to the Invisible Man. A winner is you.
A winner is you.
Winners don't use drugs.
Let's keep that.
That, I believe, is from pro wrestling, NES Pro Wrestling. A winner is you.
I still like it for this. So, okay, I think that pretty much covers everything about the Invisible Man. Anything else we need to say about this character before we wrap it up?
No, just that I'm intrigued by the story, and I would love to check out either the book or the movie, but let's be honest, the movie.
The movie is great. I recommend anyone, even though you know how it ends now, having listened to the podcast, it's really extraordinary, and the special effects, it's pretty amazing that for something from 1933, it holds up as well as it does. It's a very impressive invisibility effect.
Well, and, every movie made before, you know, the aughts or whatever, you know, you had that fun element of how do they do this, and now it's just, well, I know they did it, it's all digital.
Right, they put a guy in, well, they used something like a green screen. They put black velvet on Claude Rains, like a black velvet bodysuit, filmed him in front of black velvet, which made only the bandages and the goggles or whatever visible, and then they used that image and transplanted it into the other footage somehow. So pretty cool, pretty clever for back then.
Yeah, but it's for also audiences, just very entertaining. I'm sure that was pretty wild to see that, yeah.
Yeah, and again, that vocal performance and even his physical performance in the bandages is really top-notch. It's a lot of fun.
Cool.
So there you go. Shall we move on to Admin?
Admin!
Yay! And Admin is you.
And Admin is you.
if you want to talk to us, why wouldn't you? You can tweet at us at Podcast But Evil. That's our kind of portal. So if you like the show, again, please like, rate, and subscribe. And particularly that rate is important. If you drop us a review on iTunes, that does help increase our visibility. And hopefully other people can then check out the podcast and this thing will grow. But I know we did have some feedback this week.
We didn't get reviews, which makes the baby Jesus cry, but we did get some comments on our Q episode,
which as we're recording this was the most recent one to drop.
Right. That just came out and that was a lot of fun. Of course, from the Q episode, we got a little bit of feedback. I enjoyed this from my old friend Catherine from high school. She made the observation, I have such a love-hate relationship with Q. Like, why was Janeway able to be like, stop it, no? And Picard, who was a way better captain, was like, well, I guess we have to let this crazy alien fuck with us indefinitely. So I thought that was a funny observation. A lot of people, by the way, I noticed later on when I was looking around online, felt that Q's characterization was really solid in The Next Generation and sort of fell apart a little bit later.
I get that. Series. Yeah. I mean, for example, kind of in that same thing, we talked about it a little bit in the episode, but I believe Captain Sisko sucker punches him and Q just kind of, you know, makes some quip about it. But like, you just punched an omnipotent being in the face. Like, he could wink you out of existence. So, you know, they definitely do play fast and loose a little with that a little bit. But I think at that point, they just wanted to have more fun with Q than make him menacing. So
sure. And then this is some more feedback on the Q episode. This is from my brother, Tom. Mm-hmm. He just wrote, psst, Q wasn't really evil. Now, clearly he had not listened to the episode yet because I felt like we had addressed that it's sort of debatable how evil Q really is. I think there's a lot of Q admiration online, I also noticed.
Yeah, I think a lot of that definitely comes from that finale episode because they do a lot to, again, kind of cement this idea of like, well, Q's testing you, but maybe he really does want you to succeed. It's, you know, we talked about him being a little like Willy Wonka in that regard, right?
He's, you know, yeah. There was a comment I saw online. Someone was like, Q's like that teacher who keeps pushing you because he knows you can do better.
Maybe. He still allows people to die. Like, he's not.
Okay, so Tom also addressed this. Yeah. A little follow-up comment here. They sort of implicitly retconned Q Who, in which Q caused the Enterprise D's first encounter with the Borg, arguably the only thing Q ever did that led to long-term and deadly consequences, into a benevolent move in Voyager and Enterprise by establishing that the Borg already knew about the Federation and were already headed their way, meaning Q effectively warned the Federation about the Borg so they'd have a fighting chance. So he sort of addresses the one criticism that people have where Q actually caused the deaths of a lot of people.
Yeah, like 18 crew members or something died.
Well, that, and then there was all the subsequent encounters with the Borg, which you could arguably lay at Q's feet if you wanted to or not. Although I do find it troubling when we take evil behavior and try to rationalize it these days. I feel like there's plenty of that going around. So.
Yeah. It's all for the
greater
good.
I'm willing to take it at face value. He let a lot of people die. He's a villain.
Yeah. I think he was certainly, as we said, he's definitely an antagonist. Whether he's a villain is a little more up in the air, but I think it's fair to say he certainly starts out threatening us with annihilation and he almost follows through. So
yeah, if you were to ask Picard, like, would you rather not have to deal with Q? I think he'd be like, yes, yes, yeah. I would.
Yeah. Or how would he say it, Dan?
Yes, yes, I would.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. And there was one other comment that got left on our Twitter. I think it was just a suggestion for...
Did we do Ayn Rand as a villain?
Yeah, yeah. Ayn Rand or Ayn Rand, however you want to say it, mm-hmm. as a villain. Yes. Well, we're saving that for sweeps. And
I don't have time to read the entire Fountainhead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was from BT. Yeah, exactly. That was from BT mm-hmm. Moore, who's a frequent listener. And then MDS had said, had recommended Tom Hiddleston for Q. For playing Q.
That's a great choice, a great casting choice for Q, for sure. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for writing in, who did take the time to write in and retweet and tweet and stuff. That means a lot to us. We really appreciate it. And so I think that covers everything. We should talk about what's coming up next. So our next episode is on Charles Montgomery Burns from The Simpsons. Ah. After that, we've got La Llorona, Mexican folklore figure.
And Charles Montgomery Manson.
Yeah, Charles Manson. That's going to be fun. So I think that covers
everything. And get excited because Lauren Flans will be rejoining us. And you know her from our Jack the Ripper episode.
Yeah.
She's a real corker.
We're going to be really excited to have her back. That's going to be a lot of fun. So until next time, gentlemen, to evil.
Clink.
I'm invisible. Can you see me?
Yes.
Wow.
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.